Howdy, everybody. I'm Rose Maddox, and I'd like to tell you that you're listening to KBOO in Portland, Oregon, the station that I listen to when I'm in the area.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. One of my favorite parts of doing this show is getting to interview local authors. I am just in awe of the combination of skill, dedication, passion, and creativity required to write an entire book. And those traits are on full display in the new book, Born of Fire and Rain, Journey into a Pacific Coastal Forest, by Oregon author M.L. Herring. Born of Fire and Rain is one of the best books I've ever read on our bioregion. It is a masterfully guided hike through virtually every aspect of the Pacific coastal rainforest, seamlessly weaving in geology, ecology, timber politics, personal narratives, and a lot more into this really beautiful tapestry of this place we call home. ML is the pen name of Oregon State University Professor Emerita Peg Herring, and I am so delighted to have her on the show today. Before we get started, I have to give my usual housekeeping. Coast Range Radio is free on all podcast apps, which is a great way to share this episode with a friend or two. And the show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Reach out anytime with thoughts or show ideas. Okay, Peg Herring, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thank you, Michael. I'm happy to be here.
I am so happy to have you on and talk about Born of Fire and Rain. And before we dive in, I was hoping you could give us a short reading from the book to start us off. Would that be okay?
Sure. For thousands of years, forests have set the stage for people to tell stories about themselves. The forest might be home to hungry witches or angry fire-throwing gods, and it could be a refuge for merry men, or tricksters, or Sasquatch. All forests share a human history of conflict between worship and consumption, haunted by violence, graced by spirits, or ransacked by greedy opportunists. But what about the forest itself? What is its story? The Forest of Fire and Rain has its own epic history of disturbance and endurance. It is an intemperate rainforest at the tumultuous edge of a shifting continent. And this is its story.
Beautiful. Thank you so much for starting us off with that. And we always have to be plugging. So where can people find Born of Fire and Rain?
Well, you can order it from any bookstore or directly from Yale University Press. And it's available there all on print and also in a new audio version.
Oh, exciting. Did you read that?
No, I offered to and they were quick. to say no. And I'm glad they did because they got a really good professional reader who put a lot of life into the words and also was willing to work with me to make sure that certain words like Willamette were pronounced correctly.
Sure. Yeah, right. Yep. Lots of folks need help with some of the Oregon pronunciations of words. You know, one of the things I love about the book is, from my perspective, it is written in a way that just offers a lot to readers of all kinds. You know, there's something for the hardcore forest nerds out there. There's something for really casual readers, people maybe who don't yet even know what a cedar is from a Doug fir. It's just written in a way that I think gives something for all of us to enjoy. I wonder if that was part of your intention or if you could just talk about the intentions that you had in starting this project.
Well, like the forest itself, this book is about more than just one thing. It's not a commentary on forest management or a lyrical ode to forest bathing, although it includes both of those threads. But I was more interested in exploring this rainforest as a character with its own history and its own time-tested way of life to reveal how much is involved in just being forest. But I tell you, this certainly isn't the world I imagined I'd be bringing this book into. When I first started, I wanted to share the wonders of our coastal rainforest with people who only knew it because of our lovely scenery or our problem with owls. Mm-hmm. But even then, I could see there was a growing threat to our Northwest forest. But the threats were, at the time, like distant thunder. But now that distant thunder is more like artillery barrage aimed at the nation's forests. So this book has become an urgent invitation to explore what it means to be a forest in a rapidly shifting world.
So it sounds like you started this project a while ago.
I started this book maybe 50 or more years ago when I first moved to Oregon. It is a place that where I have lived and worked and explored for most of my life. And the idea of doing a book, an illustrated book about the place, was a natural evolution to my engagement with the place for so long.
Another thing I really love about Born of Fire and Rain is you just weave together so many different threads and themes in such a, for the reader, a beautifully effortless way. So from just a nerdy kind of narrative perspective, what was it like trying to weave all those pieces together in such a way that while you do have chapters, you know, kind of on this piece or that piece, it all blends together throughout. And I imagine that must have taken a little bit of effort and intention. Could you talk a little bit about the process of weaving all that together?
Yes. I think I said it before, but I'll say it again. Like the forest itself, this book is about a lot more than just one thing. And I wanted the reader to explore this rainforest as a character with its own agency, its own time-tested way of life. Yeah, so at the beginning of starting this book, I wanted to write it as an imagined field trip into a place where, even though 10 million people live here, very few of them understand that they live in a rainforest. So here we are, halfway between the North Pole and the equator, is this largest temperate rainforest in the world. And we are one part of it, the seasonal zone, the range of the northern spotted owl and the coastal Douglas fir region. And for us in Washington and Oregon, it's called the West Side. And here we have more rain than the fog zone in the redwoods. And we have more fire than the perpetually soggy cedars up north. So I like to say this is the sweet spot of the Pacific temperate rainforest. But because very few people even here understand its value, that's not good for anybody, because people should understand the ecosystems in which they live. But to understand our ecosystem, you can't take a hike and see it all. You don't even really find it, the field trip that is in this book. You don't even find this field trip on a map as much as you find it in your imagination. And that's because, as you know, much of the forest we see today is kept in arrested development in plantations and tree farms where trees aren't allowed to grow beyond their adolescence. And if you think about it, that's rather dystopian. But there still are beautiful stands of wild, uncut rainforest out there. And most of them are on federal land. The Siosla National Forest is a treasure, and there are other pockets of BLM and private land that have been taken care of. And these spots are among the last remnants of one of the most magnificent forests on Earth. It's a forest that rivaled the redwoods with giant trees and prodigious growth, and they dominated Western Washington and Western Oregon until about the mid-20th century, not that long ago. That's within my lifetime and perhaps the lifetime of some of your listeners. And that's important to imagine. So imagine, right now, you're squeezed between a chain of active volcanoes on one side and a massive, increasingly petulant subduction zone on the other side, which you are. And you're surrounded by a landscape that explodes and burns and slides and floods. This place is born of fire and drenched in rain and constantly changing. But despite all the turmoil from thousands of years of disturbance, this forest enjoys a distinctively benign climate for trees to grow very big and very old.
I love that. As our readers might have gathered, you not only have a science-based expertise of a lot of the subject matter, of all the subject matter we're talking about in the book. And like I say, there is a lot for kind of nerdy science types to appreciate in here, but you're also an artist. You've got so many sketches throughout the book, and you have a postscript actually in the book talking about the intersection of art and science communication. So could you talk a little bit about incorporating art in your science communication work and in this book, and maybe about your philosophy on the intersection of science and art more broadly?
This is one of my favorite topics. Yes, the illustrations in this book are from sketchbooks that I've kept for most of my life. And I think in the book, they offer a pause in the story, like you might pause on the trail in the forest, kind of a moment to stop and glimpse a fleeting owl or a mushroom in the path. So they interrupt the narrative with something that is like being on a hike, where you're interrupted by surprise. And that, in that way, art and science are similar. They're not opposites, like so many people try to make them be. So you're out on a hike, and the scenery of our temperate forest is wonderful to look at. But if you come into the forest with some understanding of how this ecosystem actually lives, that allows you to become part of something bigger than just the scenery. You know, your knowledge enlarges the wonder in it, and it gets you ready to discover something new. The details emerge and patterns come to life, and suddenly all this beautiful scenery materializes into a story with plots of relationships and characters and drama and intrigues. That's what I try to encourage scientists to see beyond just what they study, and encourage artists to understand beyond just what they draw.
I appreciate that you bring that into the work. When we look back at some of the pioneering explorers and scientists and science communicators, they were many of them also artists. And I do think those sketches really, like you say, help you pause as a kind of waypoint to, you know, use more of your senses as you read the book. So as a aspiring forest nerd, I found a lot in there that I didn't know, or deeper layers of things that I already knew some of. I'm wondering if there was anything, you know, surprising or interesting that you learned during the research of or writing process of the book.
One of the most remarkable things that I learned from this forest, privileged by how long a time I have lived here, is how this forest can rise up from the ashes and reconstruct new life from old life. And the first, possibly the most dramatic example of that was 45 years ago when Mount St. Helens erupted dramatically. Almost just the 45-year anniversary was just a few days ago. And to have known the scientists who went up there within days of that eruption, expecting to see a moonscape. In fact, it was a moonscape. But as they're crunching around the cinders of that newly born landscape, 200 feet above the old forest, they saw a filament of life coming through the ashes. And it was a fire-loving fungus that was nosing its way through the ashes. And as they continued to come back, and this is a landscape that's still very hot and very dangerous, they began to see more and more life and realized that even in this otherwise devastated landscape, that there was still life, that life had survived. And if you go back to the Mount St. Helens National Monument now, there's a towering forest growing 200 feet above where the old forest was buried. So that was my first inkling that there is something almost immortal about these forests. And the next one was quite recently, just a few years ago. We've had some bad fires in the Coast Range. Not unusual, because these forests were born of fire. But in, I think it was 2023, there was a fire in the Willamette National Forest, and it torched much of the H.J. Andrews Experimental Forest, which is a place that I have enjoyed community with some brilliant scientists who have dedicated their lives to studying how the old forest lives its life. But a couple of years ago, a fire sparked by a lightning strike burned about two-thirds of the experimental forest. And many of the older forests imagined that their life was going up in flame. And even the graduate students who had managed to keep their field experiments going through a very difficult pandemic faced starting over again from scratch. So I'll read you a bit from the book that describes this moment.
Yeah, please.
Shock, grief, and a sense of deep loss settled over the Andrews community during the long month of burning. As the scientists gathered to hear each incident report issued by fire managers, their grief slowly began to give way to questions. What will be left in the forest? What new questions might be there? What will be the next chapter of this forest's story? What's next? The Lookout Fire burned through two-thirds of the experimental forest with typical severity. Flames hardly touched some of the forest's earliest research plots, but it incinerated others. Firefighting crews protected the research buildings, and the autumn rains eventually extinguished the blaze. So, once again, we saw wildfire whipping through the rainforest, sculpting the beautiful places we love with the rough hand of fire. Few places on Earth face such titanic disturbances as those that have shaped this forest of fire and rain. And fewer still manage disturbance with such enduring grace.
Thank you for that. And I love that you brought up fire in your answer, because obviously fire is such a politically charged topic right now. And that leads perfectly into my next question, which is, you didn't shy away from politics of forest management in the book, but it also didn't feel heavy-handed. It just felt like another thread or piece of the whole that felt naturally in place there. And I, as someone who's often very heavy-handed and strident in the way I talk about things, I appreciated the way that you approached that topic. So could you talk about your thinking on how you wanted to incorporate, you know, these really difficult topics of politics, timber management, fire in the book?
Well, I wanted the forest to be able to speak for itself. These are forests that all the old growth forests that we know in the Coast Range started from fire. They were burned out and regrew. But fire isn't a common occurrence there. Our uncut rainforest has deep, damp layers of living soil and vast wet blankets of moss and ferns. There's heavy downed logs that hold water like sponges, and there's big standing trees that are armored with fire-resistant bark. So as a result, our wild, wet rainforests don't burn easily. But when it does burn, the fire can be fierce. And that's not because there are too many trees. It's because there's too much wind. Fire, whether it happens in a long-term drought with high air temperatures and low air humidity, and a spark, say a lightning strike. But it is a hot, dry, hurricane-force east wind that can ignite that spark into an inferno. And you can't stop a wind-blown firestorm. This is what we saw happen in Los Angeles last January, and it's happened in Oregon and Washington and British Columbia many times recently and in the deep past. So a lot of people are now saying that we should treat wind-blown wildfires the same way we treat tornadoes or earthquakes or hurricanes. These are all destructive events. We cannot control them, but we can prepare for them. So instead of spending $4 billion each year on industrial firefighting, which we do, perhaps we should invest some of that money into preparing our vulnerable communities with defensive spaces. But that's not the forest management that's being pushed in current legislation. I'll just say that wildfire is a deadly serious issue, and it should not be used as a political scare tactic to log our remaining rainforest. However, new federal forest policies are proposing right now to open millions of acres of federal forests to increased logging without consideration of any environmental impacts because of the implied threats of catastrophic fire. So what's worrisome is that these bills suspend the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and a lot of other rules that require scientific review and public comment. Those are being thrown out in order to, and I'll quote, expedite logging and reduce frivolous lawsuits that might interfere with timber sales. Well, wood from woodlots and tree farms can be considered a renewable resource, but a forest is not a tree farm.
Mm-hmm.
So the proposals to thin these forests will only make the forests more vulnerable. I can't speak for forest ecosystems across the country, but in our rainforest, thinning opens the forest to more sun, more wind, unnaturally high rates of drying. It compacts that deep soil and damages the underground roots and mycorrhizae, removes the moisture-holding logs, and often it removes the biggest, most fire-resistant trees in order to pay for the logging of the smaller trees. And that's logging that didn't have to happen in the first place. Thinning out a mature rainforest will not stop a windblown fire. The thinning makes our rainforest more susceptible to fire and not less.
Well, yes to all of that. And as I've said a number of times, one of the most important things listeners can do is call or email Oregon Senators Ron Wyden and Jeff Merkley and ask them to pledge to block or filibuster the so-called Fix Our Forest Act, or as I like to call it, the F the Forests Act. So any online search tool will get you to their contact pages. And you can also email me at coastrangeradio@gmail.com if you want help or more resources. We could keep talking politics all day, as far as I'm concerned, but in the interest of respecting your time, I want to hard pivot to your personal story. One thing I found out as we were prepping for this interview is actually you used to live just down the road from where I live now, kind of near Eddyville in the heart of the Coast Range. So could you tell me a little bit about your personal story and how you came to this work? And
Well, we'll take the Wayback Machine.
Uh-huh.
When I was an undergraduate at the University of Virginia studying behavioral ecology. Upon graduation, I moved with my husband-to-be to Oregon, which was Ecotopia at the time. McCall was governor, and it was the place where a whole lot of newly minted college graduates moved here, despite McCall's billboard saying, "Welcome to Oregon, but please don't stay." We all came and we all stayed. And I got a job as a fish biologist with Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I had a uniform and a boat, and it was heaven. And my husband and I bought a place in the Coast Range and built a house on the Aquinnah River. And we built the house out of old Douglas fir timbers that we had salvaged from a neighbor's barn that had collapsed 10 years earlier in the Columbus Day storm. So it was a lovely community of pioneer families that had been there for generations, and this influx of college graduated hippies who had come to Oregon when it was Ecotopia.
Yeah.
So that was my Eddyville experience. Eventually, as a biologist, I was part of the horror of witnessing the crash of the Pacific salmon. And I was pushed forward to try to explain that on behalf of the department to the legislature and to radio stations and to anyone else who was worried about it. And I became very interested in the public understanding of science. So I studied that, University of California, came back to Corvallis, and after many turns, ended up at Oregon State University as a professor of science communication. But still with a passion for translating science into words that anybody could understand. I have an early rejection letter from some highfalutin journal that said that, quote, my breezy conversational style had no place in scientific literature. Well, I still have that. That's become my North Star ever since. Was to be able to talk about the factual aspects that science reveals in a breezy and conversational style.
Absolutely. And actually, I wanted to ask you about your pen name. Did that come out of that story as well?
Well, yes. Let's see. A scientist in the 1970s would be taken more seriously if she were thought to be a man. So I was hiding behind my initials to maintain the illusion that I felt I needed to hide my gender as I published in these scientific journals. It's no longer necessary anymore, which is wonderful, but I have held on to it out of respect for that earlier me and for a long time homage to one of my favorite writers, E.B. White, who I don't think was hiding anything behind his name, except that nobody knows his name. It was an odd name. But I continue to publish under M.L. Herring, and I continue to be known to all my friends and relations as Peg.
Yeah, I mean, I love those stories for a number of reasons, but it's just a good reminder of we've come a long way in a short time.
Right.
So we have made some progress in some areas, and hopefully we can arrest the backsliding that we're seeing right now.
I do want, because we talk about big things that happen quickly, I want to go back to the fact that, well, to consider how fast we've lost so much of the rainforest in the Oregon coast. I insist that people realize that this all happened since the middle of the 20th century. It's not something that you read about, that the pilgrims in New England cut down all the trees, or the druids in Europe cut down all the trees. No, we cut down all the trees within my lifetime.
Yeah.
And less than 10% of Western Oregon's old forest still stands.
That is such an important point.
Yeah, and I think what I want to leave people with understanding is that we don't have enough public forest left to survive another round of industrial logging. That's what these new policies are calling for, and I say the forest is worth more standing than cut down.
I couldn't agree more. Peg, I have enjoyed talking with you so much today. I love Born of Fire and Rain so much. I cannot recommend it highly enough to everyone listening. I think it's destined to be a classic book of the Northwest. For now, Peg Herring, thank you so much for joining me on Coast Range Radio.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Coast Range Radio. Coast Range Radio is an independent production. If you like the show, please help me grow the audience by telling your friends about it, following Coast Range Radio on Instagram, or best of all, directly share it with a couple people by texting the link to our podcast feed. And if you don't know how to do that, you can always email me at coastrangeradio@gmail.com and I'll tell you. Or you can email me with show ideas, feedback, or just to say hi. Once again, thank you so much for listening to Coast Range Radio. We'll be back soon, and let's make it through this together.
Hi, this is Frank with a PH and a hard C. Your basic average all-American Jewish lesbian folk singer. Coming out to you on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
listening to KBOO Portland at 90.7 FM.
Bye-bye.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.